Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 176. The Dave and Jerry Show number 13, October 5th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. Hello, everyone. This week's scheduled guest had to postpone, so I called my old friend Jerry Trumbull, and we found some psychological topics to kick around. We were experimenting with video during our Skype call, and the call crashed several times during our conversation, so don't be surprised if you hear an occasional transition that seems less than smooth. Hang on to your hats, because here we go. Hey, everybody. I'm here with my good friend Jerry Trumbull again, and we've got a whole lineup of topics that we're going to be talking about today, ranging from cell phones and elephants and monkeys and stories from around the world. And I guess the common unifying element is the brain, the big brain that's behind all of that. And Jerry and I are monitoring each other on video, which we don't normally do. And if you could see what I see, we had talked about possibly putting this out as a feed, but I don't think we're going to do that. Although Jerry might, I'm not recording the video. Are you, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm recording it just at the camera level. I tried my internal computer recording, and it's not detecting the stream.
So we need to go ahead and get into this thing here. But we thought it would be good to monitor each other on video, because one of the things that inevitably happens with these Skype interview situations is a certain amount of over-talking and interrupting and not getting in a word edgewise.
Because it's hard to know. The cues are missing for the normal conversational exchange.
Yeah. Now, I see you're looking down a lot, so you got to look up so you see me waving my hand when I want to get in.
Well, I'm looking down, but I'm seeing you.
Oh, you can see me down when you're looking down. Okay.
Yeah, I'm seeing you in the Skype screen.
Okay, good.
As opposed to the camera monitor. But yeah, that's a little bit better.
Okay, good. Well, let's start off with the cell phone stuff. And we're drawing from a number of sources today, largely from one of the past issues of Scientific American Mind, which I've praised in the past, really think it's a great publication, fills an important need, and also various websites that Jerry's discovered that we will be pulling from as well. And I was intrigued by an article that was in Scientific American Mind about some studies in Australia where they actually strapped cell phones to people's heads. And guess what? It interfered with their sleep.
Yeah, really.
It sounds absurd on the face of it, you know, strapping a cell phone to somebody's head. And you would say, well, of course it disturbed their sleep. It would disturb anybody's sleep to have a cell phone strapped to their head. But actually, what they did was a little bit more subtle than that. You have that article in front of you, Jerry?
I'm just pulling it up right now.
Oh, okay.
And it says, using a mobile phone just before bed may cause insomnia.
Yeah, yeah. And in the study, what they did was they did have the phones actually attached to the person's head, and then at random intervals, I think, during the night, they would call them, or they would turn it on. I guess I have to read it. I thought I could do it from memory, but let me just read a little bit here. Neuroscientist Rodney Croft and his colleagues at, Swinburne? It's probably Swinburne, University of Technology Swinburne. In Australia, strapped a Nokia 6110 cell phone to the heads of 120 men and women and then monitored their brain waves. When the researcher switched on the phone without the subject's knowledge, they saw a sudden power boost in the volunteer's alpha brain waves. Now, that was interesting to me because I remember back in the, I guess it was the late 70s, early 80s, I was really interested in biofeedback and involved with some biofeedback research. Mm-hmm. And alpha was a good thing. Everybody was trying to get into alpha, mm-hmm. you know, because supposedly it was associated with meditative states and so on. Here they seem to be suggesting that alpha's not a particularly good thing, at least when you're trying to sleep.
Is alpha a stage of slow wave, or is it a stage of wakefulness? I've forgotten my...
Well, it's been a while for me, too, but it's. I recall that there are four primary waveforms, and they're beta. Actually, beta, I believe, is sort of the waveforms, kind of very mixed set of waves that are associated with wakefulness, if I recall correctly. Alpha is deeper than that. Things begin to slow down, if I recall correctly, to around 10 cycles per second.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have theta, which is on the way to delta. Delta is deep sleep,
mm-hmm.
which I think is like around 4 cycles per second. And I think theta might be around 8. I'm really reaching back into the recesses of the old cortex here. Way
sounds
down
about
into
right
the real
to me.
Wrinkles. I'm getting down into the wrinkled part here.
In more ways than one.
Right. In a later place in this article, it says, in a different study, sleep researchers at Loughborough, I don't know, not doing great on these names, Loughborough University in England found that after 30-minute exposure to cell phone signals in talk mode, people took nearly twice as long to fall asleep as they did when the phone had been off or in standby mode. The scientists think that the effect probably reflects the time it takes the brain to relax after being agitated by the phone's electrical field. Your thoughts, Jerry Trumbull.
I did a little research this morning what I wanted was a visualization of the sphere of radiation that engulfed your head when you were actually talking on the phone.
Oh, yeah. Did you find anything like that?
Not the visualization part, but I did find studies that showed how intense it was. And apparently the effect is a heat effect of the RF radio frequency energy heating up your head.
Oh, wow. That makes sense, because I remember when I was a ham radio operator that if you weren't careful, you would get something called RF burns, radio frequency burns, off the transmitter, depending upon what kind of power you were running. And so touching someplace in the back of the transmitter or grabbing a piece of antenna wire, you would actually get a burn on your hand.
Uh-huh. That makes sense. Although we don't normally think about radio waves causing burns. In fact, I always wondered what kind of an environment we were normally sitting in with respect to radio frequency. Obviously, we're being bombarded by all sides, since we can turn on a radio at any time and pick up all these channels. I mean, they're coming in whether our radio is on or not. And I the closest I came to this was one time when I was renting an apartment. The prospective tenant showed up with a meter. He was from Boulder, so I wasn't sure if it was real or not. But that's an inside joke.
That's a Colorado joke.
Yeah, Boulder is a special place. But
that's like people around here talk about Berkeley.
Mm-hmm, same deal. Yeah. The Republic of Boulder, the Republic of Berkeley.
Exactly, the People's Republic of Berkeley, they say.
Yeah, exactly the same thing. At any rate, so I said, oh, that's cool. And he said, yeah, I have to check out the apartment to see if it's got an excess of electromagnetic forces And I thought, okay. And I was kind of curious because it looked real. And he went around the apartment and he paid special attention to the electrical outlets and the switches and so on and so forth. I think he concluded that it was too high and that he didn't want to rent the apartment as a result. But I've often wondered, you know, what if
was he wearing tin foil on his head?
Not that I remember. At any rate, I thought that was kind of curious, and I always wanted to be able to see radio frequency or even electromagnetic waves of any kind, just to see what we're sitting in, you know, because I have a feeling we're at a very, very low level. We're sitting in a huge cloud of radio frequency waves, and now with cell phones, obviously even more. So I've never been able to get a picture.
Yeah. I've often kind of referred to that in when I was teaching in talking about how our senses don't give us a direct window onto the world, and mm-hmm. how there's so much more going on that we're not aware of. And radio frequencies, as well as other kinds of radiation, you know, coming from the sun and elsewhere in the universe, all these particles that are streaming through us and by us that we don't see, we don't experience, and that, frankly, it's hard to believe in.
Yeah, I think if we could see them, we would probably run screaming back into the forest.
right.
Because it would be red and blue and yellow, and it would just be clogging up our senses. But yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, now with the advent of radio astronomy, you see these photographs of waves that we can't detect with our eyes, and you see how much more there is out there that we're not detecting. It's kind of scary when you think about the totality of it.
Yeah. Now, coming back to the cell phone thing, I don't talk on the cell phone all that much these days, and I certainly don't talk on, you know, just before I'm going to bed. What I have noticed is that I have to be careful not to work on the computer too much before I go to bed. It's best if I have about an hour separating from when I've been on the computer and when I go to bed. And so I have to wonder if there isn't something similar going on with the computer. And of course, I'm also wondering now, as I'm talking about this, I'm aware that I now have a flat screen monitor. And so I remember with the cathode ray tube monitors, there were people who were asserting that that cathode ray tube was shooting a beam, not just against the face of the monitor, but that some of those particles were going through, you know, all the way into our head.
Yeah, I think that's true, actually. Or maybe I believe that because when my mother was always telling us, you're sitting too close to the TV. You have that it could hurt you if you sat real close to it, so you had to sit back. Now, she didn't have any knowledge of ion beams and so on, but that was kind of drilled into me as a child. And now I, especially with the old monitors, you know, now I'm sitting 10 inches away from it.
Right.
And by her standards, that would have been terrible. But with the flat screen, yeah, I guess there's no beam of particles aimed at us anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to confess I've been in denial about this whole cell phone thing because I, you know what a gadget hound I am, and I love my iPhone, and I'm really attached to it and don't want to give it up. But you dug up a couple of articles on the web that are... Can you hear all these dogs howling in the background here, by the way?
Just barely.
Yeah, you know, when the fire trucks go by, we have an army of dogs that just start howling like crazy. And
right.
they're all singing away right now. So there were two things that I wanted to talk about here that you dug up. One comes from Breitbart.com. I guess it's summarizing a story from somewhere else. But these are recent. You know, a lot of times when I go on the web, they don't put the date on a lot of websites. And, you know, that bothers me.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's like, is this old stuff or new stuff? And I think I was able to determine in both of these cases that this is fresh information. And so here's one called Scientists Warn U.S. Congress of Cancer Risk for Cell Phone Use. You want to summarize that a little bit for us?
I would if I could find it. You go ahead?
I thought you'd have all this stuff up and ready to go.
Hey, normally I would.
Yeah, I'm normally. Mr. Organized today. Well, it says scientists on Thursday warned U.S. legislators of the risks of brain cancer from cell phone use, highlighting the potential risk for children who use mobile phones. And I think, you know, the big concern there is that kids are probably on their cell phones a lot more than adults are. Of course, a lot of them are texting, and that's probably good because then they don't have it up against their head.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that I'm thinking about this is, I know with my iPhone, I have earbuds that I can use that have a little built-in microphone as well. Now, frankly, I don't use the earbuds much, but probably I should use them a lot more because my guess is that that risk would be largely mitigated by not having the phone so close to your head.
Yes, indeed. I found an article. I didn't reference it, but that's what it said. Use your hands-free option, whatever that happens to be, so you don't have the device up against your head, because it seems like it's actually having it pressed to your head that causes the problems. But in that study, if I remember correctly, I can't seem to find it, but it said that young kids who use cell phones would be five times more likely to develop brain cancer later on in life if they had a lot of intensive cell phone use as young children. Is that what it says? You've got it in front of you.
Yeah, that definitely rings a bell. And now I'm looking at this other article that you sent my way from a site, says The Independent, and it's their science section. This is probably the one you're referring to. The headline says, mobile phone use raises children's risk of brain cancer fivefold. Alarming new research from Sweden on the effects of radiation raises fears that today's youngsters face an epidemic of the disease in later life. And this is from Sunday, September 21st, 2008. And they mentioned that, you know, there have been a bunch of earlier studies that say, no, you don't have to worry about it. And what these more recent research people are saying is that those earlier studies were flawed, that there were methodological problems. And so this is something, I guess, that isn't going to go away. And that first article that I was reading from, they say that they think that we're at the place where smoking was about 30 years ago, where there was a lot of denial, you know, where some people were raising the alarm, but there was a lot of sort of pressure from the tobacco companies and a lot of just kind of resistance and denial. Whereas today, you know, it's just the evidence is just too strong. So we may be on a similar arc in relation to cell phones. Now, I wonder what about I've got a Bluetooth device that I plug into my ear. I would assume that that's a lot safer than the phone, that that's not really putting out. Well, I don't think it's putting out a signal. It must be putting out a bit of a signal, actually, to be able to talk to the phone. But it would be very, very low power.
Yeah, in fact, one of the studies I looked at this morning was talking about actual wattage and from your ham days, radio amateur. It was between 1.5 and 3 watts, which, as I recall, is very low.
Yeah, yes and no. Yes and no, because depending upon what frequency spectrum you're working in, we're on the radio band, there is a whole sort of sub-hobby within amateur radio of people who try to see how far away they can talk on low power. And so I forget what that's called, but there are people who've really been able to talk pretty much around the world on 1 watt, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, because that is very low power, kind of the standard amount of power that that most hams are restricted to, as I recall, is 100 watts. And that's sort of standard equipment comes out these days at 100 watts. And it used to be possible to get amplifiers where you could have 1,000 watts. I'm not sure what the rules on that are now, if that's allowed anymore or not. You know, I was thinking the other day, I casually mentioned ham. I think I was a guest speaker in the class, and I said something about ham radio operator. And then I realized that, you know, all of these are really young students, young right. college students. And so they must think, I wonder what they think, because it used to be that everybody knew what a ham was, and now they're probably confused. Why is he talking about pigs and radio
or hamming it up? Maybe they thought that it was a radio operator who was hamming it up, whatever that means. Yeah. I don't know about that either.
The risks of getting older here in your vocabulary. Hey, well, we've spent a lot more time on this topic than I had intended. We've got a lot more to cover. You sent me a link from the Discovery Channel. People can go to the Discovery Channel, to the video area, and find the thing that you sent me about elephants recognizing themselves.
Yeah, it was in line with our previous discussions about animal awareness, self-awareness, and so on. I think we've mentioned before that chimpanzees will spend time watching themselves in a mirror, touch the mirror, and you can see they're interacting. And then eventually you can see that they come to understand that it's them. Usually they put some kind of a mark on the animal, and then they watch the animal, and they notice that the animal will touch that spot on their head, for example, which they can't see except in the mirror.
Yes, right. And presumably they're trying to rub it off, or they recognize it's something strange and new.
And they did the same thing with elephants, and they put a big white X up above the on the forehead of the elephant, and then they watched, and sure enough, the elephant, seeing that in the mirror, would then touch that spot on themselves, indicating that they knew that the mirror was actually them. I guess that's what they concluded from that. And it was just another animal to add to the list: dolphins, chimpanzees. I don't know about monkeys. I don't know how far down it goes. But it's just a measure, I guess, that we can use to somehow try to relate our own experience to the animal experience. And we have a lot of trouble with that.
I was surprised that I was a little surprised. I thought I already knew this or had heard about this, but maybe I was generalizing from – I was surprised about the dolphins, too, because that – you know, they're in the water. it seems like it might be a little bit harder to measure, but I guess they've done that.
Yeah, in fact, I'm sure you remember old Dr. What's-His-Name.
John.
Yeah.
I'm blocking on his name.
Dolphin guy.
Yeah, the LSD researcher who'd get in the tank with the dolphins. Is that the guy you're thinking of?
Yeah, and he eventually built a laboratory right on the coast so that his experimental subjects could come and go, which I thought was a great thing. And I went to hear him speak at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was quite an interesting fellow, especially with the experiment in which the dolphin lived in a, quote, apartment with a human. And they... the apartment was filled up to a 3 or 4 foot level with water for the dolphin, and then the human had to walk around in that. But they had a cot that the human could get out of the water. But the thing that was interesting from that talk, having nothing to do with what we've been talking about, was that the I guess these horny dolphin males were always trying to come on to the female human. Which I found somewhat interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And it's John Lilly, by the way. I use the prosthesis for my brain known as Google, and I typed in Dolphin Researcher John.
Yeah.
And came right up. Oh, yes, John Lilly, M.D.
John Lilly. Yeah, and then his, LSD, and he was an interesting guy. He was kind of pioneering in his day, and I don't know that anybody else is doing that kind of stuff these days. But the self-awareness part, I guess we could probably have guessed that dolphins would be in that group because they have such large brains.
Yeah, and same for the elephant. And I feel pretty sure that it's been done with chimps.
Yeah, chimps, no doubt.
Yeah, chimps and probably gorillas too.
I wondered about, say, rhesus monkeys, which we used to use a lot in the research at Walter Reed. Whether they had the same self awareness, I have no idea.
Yeah, well, that's a good transition into this other article from Scientific American September issue that I wanted to get into, which had to do with a voice recognition center, speech recognition center in a certain kind of monkey that they've studied. And I don't know how to pronounce it, and I don't know if you have it up. I think I sent you a link to this article.
Yeah, you did. I'm trying to find it here. Macaque.
Macaque. Is that how you say it? Okay.
That's how we used to say it. I don't know if that's correct or not.
Okay. Well, this is kind of an intriguing article, I think, because they're figuring, okay, well, given that, the whole process of evolution, our ability to recognize speech must not have just come in full-blown all at once, but would have evolved over time. Mm-hmm. And so they think maybe they're on to some of those sort of evolutionary way stations with these monkeys. They say here, how did our ancestors become the only speaking animals some tens of thousands of years ago? Did this change happen abruptly, involving the sudden appearance of a new cerebral region or pattern of cerebral connections, or did it happen through a more gradual evolutionary process? Hey, well, that's what I just said.
Yeah.
It must be that I read it. Okay.
Well, when I hear of studies such as this, I'm always totally amazed at how often as humans we have made the same mistake of thinking of ourselves as the center of the universe, the chosen species, so to speak, and that we have all these talents and that the animals don't have them. And now, of course, with a little more subtlety to our experimentation, we learn that a dog is not just barking, he's actually communicating, and he has 9 different kinds of barks and different patterns and everything. And it makes me always suspect that the animal communication, especially among animals that we can hear, is probably a lot more complex than we ever imagine, and that combinations of sounds serve to form concepts for the animals. You know, like there's somebody coming that seems to be another dog or another human, that there's some subtlety that we're missing. And it seems like the more research we do, the more we find out that that's the case and that we're not the only ones that have language. Now, if you want to talk about language in the Chomsky sense, maybe we are the only ones. I don't know, with syntax and all that. But I don't know. I'm trying to remember the chimpanzees that were taught to sign. It seems to me that they did have what Chomsky would think of as true language capabilities. Is that your recollection? Using words in a new way, in a new sentence, combining words for new meaning. Actually, I think in the chimp studies, they actually found that animals would create new words out of old words.
Yeah, as the last I heard, there were still some sort of hardheads who were reluctant to accept that. But I think the weight of opinion has shifted in that direction of recognizing sort of true language abilities. One of the things that blows my mind here is just how long evolution has been going on. They say the voice area has a long evolutionary history and was probably present some 20 million years ago. Mm-hmm. Now that blows my mind. 20 million years of life on this planet? How far back does it go? I mean, that's amazing to me.
Yeah, it is amazing. In fact, whenever I have occasion to think about what I call geological time, it blows me away because it makes one realize that our existence on the planet is, as I read the other day, a mere hiccup.
Yeah, right.
The total human, what do you want to say, that humans as we know them went back 30,000 years. In fact, I just watched a movie last night, 10,000 B.C., on DVD last night, and it was, you know, the story of how some cavemen came down and eventually discovered that the Egyptians were doing all kinds of cool stuff that they didn't know about. But yeah, we've been here such a short period of time, and it's hard for me to imagine that with this auditory area in the brain or this language area in the brain, that we're the first ones to be able to call what we do language. I think these languages exist in lower animals and that we have been ignorant of them, that we've been assuming that we were at the top of the heap as usual, you know. We're number one.
Yeah. Well, let me read just, I'm going to read one more paragraph here. It says, the researchers found evidence for a voice area in the auditory cortex of the macaques, a discrete region of the anterior temporal lobe in which activity was greater for macaque vocalizations than for other sound categories. This region was observed in several individuals, even under the condition of total anesthesia. More surprising, the region showed repetition-induced reduction of activity or neuronal adaptation in response to different calls coming from the same individual. This finding suggests that the brain region processes information about the identity of the speaker, a phenomenon that is also observed in the human voice area. So that's interesting that at the neuronal level, there's evidence that they're recognizing the speaker. Okay. Let's talk about stories.
Storytelling, oh no.
Storytelling, yeah. You know, one of the things that I think has been one of the big bonds of our friendship and relationship, I think, has been storytelling. Would you agree?
I'd have to agree, yeah. I think probably the fact that we actually listen to each other's stories, that's the hard part. I mean, everybody's got stories, and I don't know that everybody enjoys telling their stories as much as we do, but the hard thing is to find somebody that actually listens to your story.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely part of it. You know, we both had the ambition of being writers. We met early on in college, and we both ended up switching out of engineering programs and majoring in creative writing.
Right.
And so I think we both had an affection for story, and something that we shared was the desire to live a life that would be worthy of storytelling. In other words, we wanted to lead heroic lives that would give us lots of stories to tell.
Right. True. In fact, I always thought that young writers were kind of silly because they didn't have the experience. I always thought, as I grew older, that I was building up some kind of storehouse of stories and experience that would make me a better writer. Maybe it was just an excuse to not do much writing.
Yeah. Well, I went through the same thing, and I filled my storehouse chock full, and now I've got the time, but I can't remember the stories.
That's great. I love that. Dave's storybook.
Empty.
Empty, yeah.
So at any rate, I remember you as a very charismatic storyteller. You drew lots of people around you who were eager to hear your stories. I do understand that now, these many years later, family members who've heard the stories a number of times, and I'm in a similar situation, sometimes they don't want to keep hearing the same stories over and over again.
You know, the old tradition of the storyteller as a person who passed along vital information, the story, the mythical storyteller. I guess that's totally gone now. The story lives on in the form of television and movies and all kinds of video, and the individual telling a story. People, I think a lot of people have kind of lost that skill. I don't know. I'm just trying to think in my own experience.
Well, I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, as a cultural thing of telling each other stories, yes, I do think that's changed. But I would imagine that there's every bit as much of a tendency for people to tell stories about themselves and about their lives. As a matter of fact, this conversation was triggered by an article in that same September issue of Scientific American Mind, an article called The Secrets of Storytelling. And it's a fairly extensive article, and it's got some good points in it. First of all, that storytelling is so universal. It plays a huge role in every culture that they've studied. Mm-hmm. Throughout time, everywhere, storytelling mm-hmm. is universal. Mm-hmm. One of the things that intrigued me that I think you might find interesting is there is this sort of narrative tendency that we have, or this tendency to project a story. You know, some people have claimed that dreams don't really have a story that's coming up from beneath, but that somehow we project that on there. Well, there was some interesting research cited in this article about if they showed subjects some rather neutral geometric images, like a triangle that's moving around a circle, that mm-hmm. as people would talk about it, they'd say, and now the triangle is chasing the circle. Mm-hmm. And so that there was this tendency to turn it into a narrative. I thought that was kind of fascinating.
Mm-hmm. To maybe put some structure to it to make it easier to remember or understand. I don't know.
Yeah. That seems to be one of the functions of story, really. You know, from a Jungian perspective, I've thought that story is extremely important, and that arc, you know, what the Jungians refer to as the archetypes, like the hero and the high priest and the healer and the wise old woman, and all of those elements are kind of in some deep structure that we have inside us, and that these form kind of the atoms, if you will, of our storytelling, that these elements seem to be pretty universal. And so I was interested in this article that they come to a conclusion, I thought, that's pretty similar to the kind of conclusion that I've come to from a Jungian point of view, is that story is really important for social cohesion. Stories kind of tell us who we are and where we fit in the grand scheme of things.
Hmm. And that, explain what you mean by social cohesion.
Well, oops. In another podcast interview. Actually, I've talked about this, I think, in a few podcasts, so I don't want to go into it too deeply. Mm-hmm. But you know how animals, other species, have instincts that, and the purpose of the instincts of the dolphins the salmon that swim upstream to their spawning grounds, and the birds that build nests, and the spiders that instinctively spin their webs and so on, that the ultimate purpose of all of that has to do with survival of the species. So the question then arises, well, what would be the function of these archetypes and this storytelling to do with the survival of the human species? And it's been asserted that as humans, we're social animals. So I think that our storytelling, I think that what binds us together as humans is a web of meaning, that we have to understand who we are in the universe and in relation to other social groups and our standing within our own social group, and that stories, myths, fairy tales, all of that helps define that for us and helps hold us all together. Part of the mm-hmm. evidence for that is when you see Western civilization impacting more primitive, so-called more primitive cultures, and their story becomes broken by the story of science and Western civilization and so on. What happens is that earlier culture begins to fall apart, that people actually get sick, die, the social cohesion begins to fall apart.
Mm.
That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, it certainly seems to have validity just thinking about it. I mean, without being very knowledgeable. In fact, I often believed, without much information, that my storytelling tendencies were inherited, that I came from a long line of storytellers. I don't know where I got that idea.
Do you have any evidence for that? I mean, do you recall your older brothers or your dad or uncles being great storytellers or grandparents?
My father was a good storyteller. He had certain classic stories that he liked to tell. And then my grandfather, he wasn't much of a storyteller, but somehow I have this notion that my ancestors were gypsies.
Well, this is interesting because you're usually, you don't go off into those sort of mystical realms of past lives, etc. So that's kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Some kind of a huckster on the back of a wagon of some kind.
Uh-huh.
Gather around, boys and girls, and let me tell you the story of blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, right. I can relate to that. Elmer Gantry, I don't know if anybody familiar with the Elmer Gantry story of that.
Yeah.
The evangelist, yeah. You know, the evangelist huckster.
Yeah.
That's kind of an archetypal thing. Well, I've been known among my friends, not just you, but in later life after our paths diverged, I'm kind of known as a storyteller, and that was something that I think I got a lot of strokes for as a teacher. As mm-hmm. I say, I'm not telling as many of those stories now, both because I've kind of forgotten a lot of them, and some of them I've told so many times, I've just kind of gotten tired of them. I don't know, they've lost some of the energy for me. Have you gone through any of that?
It's hard to say because when my hair turned white, I could tell immediately that I had lost my mojo as a storyteller.
Oh, no. Hey, it's seriously. Supposed to get better. You become an elder, the wise man.
Yeah, but we don't have that much anymore. And I know, I also spent a lot of my life as a teacher, and the storytelling really helps when you're up in front of people and you want to bring them in and kind of get them going.
Exactly. There's some part of our brain that is wired to respond to that, and they talk about that. Go ahead, Don. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just thinking, I remember the time back in 08 when or whatever, you know, some kind of thing like that. But now, like I said, what happened was I was teaching in my own computer training company up until 1990, and my beard turned white long before my hair turned white. So having a white beard was okay. Then my company was doing very well, and I thought, boy, you know, I could retire and have my company just pay me monthly. I could be any place in the world. So I kind of retired from that in 1990. But as the world of computer training changed, by about 1993, I went back into the classroom to continue teaching. And apparently over that period of time, my hair had changed considerably. And I just noticed an immediate effect that for some reason, like I said, my mojo or my magnetism or something, it was like the old guy, you know. Now he's going to launch into a story. Oh, my God, no. you know that reaction, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit more sensitive to storytelling. Although I also noticed another phenomenon. If you're about to tell a story and you ask the listener, have you heard me talk about this before, or have you heard this story before? And they say, yes, I've heard this story before. oftentimes that doesn't stop you from telling the story.
That's when you know you're getting old.
Well, it's like you have a need. You have a need to tell the story.
Yeah, well, that's true. There is a need to tell the story.
And whether or not they've heard it is not important. Even to the point, and this is what happens to me, if they say yes, I'll try to condense it down to a couple of sentences.
Yeah, but then it loses something, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, you mentioned writing as storytelling, and I've tried that. I'm sure you've tried it. And at one point, I was trying to finish a novel, basically autobiographical, of my experiences as a landlord. And, I think I even mentioned that on one of the previous shows.
Yeah, the last one.
And I wrote about 100 pages. In fact, when I look back on that now, I'm going like, oh, yeah, there's a story I totally forgot, you know, and I'm glad I wrote it down because I started this back in the 90s, the early 90s. But as I wrote the story down, it seemed to lose some of its luster or its interest to me. It started to devolve into a bigger story, really, about my whole life and the disintegration of my ambition and my family, and it got so depressing I had to stop writing it.
Oh, my goodness. Let's see.
I know.
We need a psychologist.
We're having a great show.
Well, you know, let's see, we're running long here. And I wanted you to tell a story. I had a story for you. And also I wanted to just say that they did some research. They found that in this article they talk about 65% of human conversation, both male and female, seems to be what they would call storytelling.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. So I thought that was a very interesting finding.
That's much higher than I would have thought.
And also and somebody else boiled it down to that basically there are three themes, three kinds of stories across the world. And the three that they identify are romantic, heroic, and sacrificial. So I thought that was kind of interesting. People can go to this article if they want to find out a little bit more about what was meant by each of those. And the other thing was that there are gender differences. And again, these are gender differences that, according to the article here, I'm trying to find the place right now, because anytime you mention gender, it's going to be very controversial. And it was kind of a controversial finding here. But they talk about a team that did a content analysis of 90 folktale collections, each consisting of 50 to 100 stories from societies running the gamut from industrial nations to hunter-gatherer tribes. They found overwhelmingly similar gender descriptions emphasizing strong male protagonists and female beauty. To counterbalance the possibility that male storytellers were bending or biasing gender idealizations, the team also sampled cultures that were more egalitarian and less patriarchal. However, they still found those differences, and they say the difference in gender stereotypes may reflect the classic Darwinian emphasis on reproductive health in women, signified by youth and beauty, and on the desirable male ability to provide for a family, signaled by physical power and success. You know, and I think a lot of those early storytelling stories that we like to swap and all were, in fact, about our young male prowess in one way or another, you know, our adventures, our sexual adventures, our risk-taking, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I guess that could be. I don't know. I don't remember trading sexual prowess stories because
well, I don't want to give a misleading example idea here.
Well, because we weren't getting any, so we didn't have any stories to tell.
This is a conversation for another time. Dr. Really? Dave will only go so far here in this arena. Oh, well, I just know that you've been making some new friendships, you know, recently. And I just wonder how, you know, like you went off with this Politico guy off into the wilderness on a horseback trip and so on. Weren't you swapping stories as part of that?
No, I was listening. I was listening because the gentleman that you're talking about, and by the way, you can check his stories out if you go to wesmckinley.blogspot.com. WESMCKINLEY, wesmckinley.blogspot.com. I put together, he's a politician, although he would hate to hear me say that. He's a cowboy in Colorado, and he's running for his third term for the Colorado House of Representatives. I met him at a party about a year ago, and when I found out who he was, I was totally amazed because I knew his story before I met him, because he was the foreman of the Rocky Flats grand jury. And locally here in Colorado, that was a big story around Denver because Rocky Flats was a nuclear weapons plant that was built, oh, I think it's about 10 miles to the northwest of Denver. And when I first moved here and I found that out, I was going like, well, that's pretty terrible because we're downwind from that installation. And sure enough, there are all kinds of horror stories. I won't go into them, but it was a big sloppy operation run by Rockwell and all kinds of violations. Eventually, it was raided by the FBI, the only time in history where the FBI actually raided another government department, and it was shut down. And then there was a big trial. And just by happenstance, Wes, the gentleman that we're talking about, was, you know, he got his jury summons. Well, he lives, I mean, Colorado is a big state. He lives about 5 hours away from Denver, way down in the southeast corner. And Walsh, Colorado. And so it was a big hassle for him to come up here. And grand juries, unlike normal juries, meet for a certain length of time. And they are normally impaneled for a year. And they meet, in his case, they met for 1 week a month. But it took 2.5 years. So he had to come up here and... And he was selected as the foreman of the jury. Well, that was a big mistake from their point of view because Wes is a very interesting kind of a guy. He's well educated. He was a math and science teacher. He's kind of a homespun kind of a fellow. He really is a cowboy. I mean, he actually has real cows and. He takes care of them and he slaughters them and he sells the meat and or organic beef, I should point out. And but what happened on the grand jury was that he was a little bit too inquisitive. For example, he didn't normally it's the prosecutor that talks to the grand jury and tells them what they want to do and then the grand jury goes along with whatever the prosecutor tells him. But Wes was a little bit different. He actually found that there was a handbook for grand juries in Colorado, and he actually read it and noticed that they were deviating from the normal procedure, and that once impaneled, a grand jury is really independent. They can really do anything they want to do. They can even go out. They can even demand that people be dragged in off of the street and made part of their grand jury. They have all kinds of power. So as the foreman, he began to exercise some of this power. And as the evidence was presented over a long period of time, he and his fellow grand jury people decided that they were going to indict individuals, government officials, as well as companies. And that threw the prosecutor into a big tizzy. And so there was a standoff between the prosecutor and the grand jury. And the way I got to originally find out about this was seeing on television, local television here, Wes McKinley in his typical cowboy everyday outfit, you know, Levi's and cowboy hat and the whole deal, standing on the courthouse steps, the federal courthouse downtown here in Denver, and talking in a way that you don't hear normal people talk. He was telling the straight truth. He was telling it like it is. And he just had a down-home mannerism way about him that made you believe that he was actually telling you the truth. So it was a big standoff. They eventually, of course, a grand jury is sworn to secrecy before they start. And eventually a deal was struck between the defendants and the prosecutor. Rockwell International, I think it was, paid $18 million fine. It was the biggest environmental fine at the time. And the grand jury was dismissed. But they didn't dismiss themselves. They continued to meet, and they continued to say that justice had not been done. And then Wes and an attorney wrote a book, which I highly recommend. It's called Ambushed Grand Jury, and you can find out about it on the web at ambushedgrandjury.com. And here he was in person, and I was meeting this guy that I, you know, that I had only heard about, and he was he was singing and playing the guitar.
Yeah,
he was a politician who comes to the event, brings his own hamburger meat, cooks it for you, and then while you're eating, he entertains you by singing and playing the guitar with his sidekick Billy. So I was videotaping at that event, and I just loved the way he came across on videotape. So I kind of told him, I said, look, Wes, anytime you need some videotape, just give me a call. Well, he did. And if you go to that website, Wes McKinley, you'll see all kinds of video that I've done of him, because I'm trying to aid in his reelection campaign.
Okay, well, I'm going to cut in here. That was a story.
Yeah,
that was a story about how you didn't tell any stories when you met this guy because you already knew his story. We're running long here, but there was a story that you told me the last time that you and I talked when we weren't on the air here. And mm-hmm. A lot of times that's when the best stuff comes out. It's when nobody else is listening. And then I always go, oh, I should have recorded that. So I'm hoping you can recapture the energy, but I really got off on this story that you told about this sort of nightmare adventure involving a dog.
Yeah, I've got a lot of those stories.
Well, at this point, Jerry launched into the story, and he was well underway when our Skype connection conked out once again. So out of fatigue and frustration, we decided to hang it up for the day. So I'll leave you with this cliffhanger, and I'll remind Jerry to share the story the next time we get together. It's a good one, I promise you. And by the way, there'll be links to all the articles that Jerry and I discussed in the show notes at the Shrink Wrap Radio website.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
There's a new interview up on my other podcast series at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an inspiring conversation with Frank Ochberg, MD, on post-traumatic stress disorder. It's one of those special interviews where I felt a very high degree of rapport with my guest. We're running short on time, so I'm going to squeeze in the one email that I'm going to read right here. And it goes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. As an avid listener and licensed marriage family therapist, I really appreciate everything you do and have listened to all your shows. I have just purchased through your site my first ad for my company, 99 Lollipop, a place where people can find reasonably priced, one-of-a-kind items that are handmade, knit, and crocheted, as well as embellished with embroidery. I also will custom make just about anything. In addition, I have a stuffed animal rehab service where I fix up those precious friends that tend to get pretty ill over the years. Hopefully, your listeners will visit my site, especially as the holidays rapidly approach. I feel honored to be displayed on your page and to give back for all your amazing work. Thank you, and keep up the good work." And that's from Rachel Spencer of 99 Lollipop. So you'll find a link to Rachel's handmade gifts in the number one slot of our Top Spots widget in the upper right-hand corner of the Shrink Wrap Radio web pages. The Top Spots widget on our site is a place where you can help support the show and advertise your blog, website, or service at the same time, all for a mere $20 PayPal donation. And that's what Rachel has done, and I thank her for it. And also, thanks to all of you who've taken advantage of the various discount offers from our four sponsors. You'll find links on our website to discounts at GoDaddy, Brookstone.com, Budget.com, Car Rentals, and PetMeds.com. And using those codes not only saves you money, but also helps to support Shrink Wrap Radio. For example, using the code SHRINK2 at GoDaddy can save you 20% off any order of $50 or more. And I know some of you are responsible for ordering lots of domain names, so 20% can be substantial. And another example is you can get a 10% discount at Brookstone.com by using our code SHOWRAP. And you can also get a 10% discount at Budget Car Rentals by using our code SHRINK. Each of the codes is a little bit different. Finally, you can save 10% off plus get free shipping on orders over $39 at PetMeds.com using the code SHRINK. So you can find all these codes and links to these offers on our website at ShrinkWrapRadio.com. So with that, I think I'm going to wrap it up for today. I want to thank my friend Jerry Trumbull again for hanging out with me. And once again, next week's guest, I hope, will be Jim Howden, who comes from the world of business, and we'll be talking about his book on the art of engagement. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.